Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about infertility issues with our guest today. She is Dr. Laura Cooney. Laura, a reproductive endocrinology infertility specialist at UW Health's Generations Fertility Care Clinic. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, specializes in female infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, and we'll learn about that for sure, fertility preservation, and third-party reproduction. So, infertility on our minds to begin the show here. What questions do you have? Have you had problems conceiving? What has been your experience? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Dr. Laura Cooney, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Glad to have you with us today. Well, let's just start with a definition. What's the clinical definition of infertility?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to think about it. Probably the easiest way is a couple who's been trying to get pregnant, having regular intercourse, and unable to achieve a pregnancy over a year, so 12 months of trying.
Okay, and that's the same depending on age?
Another good question. So, we generally recommend that if someone's under 35, you know, they try for a year before seeking help, you know, going to talk to their doctor. If someone's over 35, we usually only say to wait 6 months before they come in and talk to us.
Okay. And how common is it?
It's surprisingly common. You know, 12 to 15% or so of couples won't conceive after those 12 months. It's something that a lot of people don't talk about to their friends. And so sometimes it's surprising to realize how common it is.
Now, if I was married and I was in that sort of situation, I would probably want to seek out a specialist, somebody like you probably, but yeah. Is a specialist needed?
Not necessarily initially. You know, we work really closely both with general obstetric gynecology physicians as well as family practitioners, internal medicine. A lot of the initial workup can be done by them, you know, thinking about whether a woman's ovulating, checking to see if her tubes are open, thinking about initial tests for the man. All of that can be run with your general OBGYN.
And would that be on a first appointment, all that? Or what's the first appointment like?
The first appointment, you go in, get a really good menstrual history. So talk a lot about, you know, is she getting regular periods? Do we think she's ovulating? Does she have history of infections that might make her more likely to have her tubes be blocked? Does she have fibroids, heavy bleeding, problems with her uterus? Has she had multiple miscarriages in the past? So again, really good history. Again, talking to her partner, if it's a male, about his history. And most of the time, a lot of these tests can really be ordered that first visit.
Yeah, I was thinking about friends, and this goes back several years. All the tests on the wife were fine, and finally turned to the husband, and it was really a problem with the husband.
Yeah, we try to not sort of get pigeonholed into thinking it's just the woman's issue.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So what do the statistics say about that? I mean, how often is it the male?
So generally about 10 to 20% of the time, we actually don't find a diagnosis. So this unexplained infertility, which is one of the most frustrating diagnoses for couples. And then, you know, the easy way to think about it is a third of the rest of the time, it's, you know, a female issue, a third is a male issue, and a third is, you know, both. So something that we find on both sides.
Tell us about the couples clinic at Generations Fertility.
Yeah, so we have a male urologist with us, Dr. Daniel Williams, and it's super helpful. So couples can, when they come in for their first visit, instead of, you know, just seeing me and then having to wait a week or a month to see someone to talk about the male issues. They can actually see both of us on the same day. It can be really helpful, you know, especially if they already have had some testing and we know that there's something going on with them. But it can also be helpful for that very first visit, even if they've had no testing. Dr. Williams will do an exam, think about hormones from the male side. Everyone thinks about female hormones, but a lot of the same hormones play a role in guys as well.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And tell me about polycystic ovary syndrome. That's something, a term I just learned here recently, like a few hours ago.
Well, we can abbreviate it to PCOS. Okay. So that's what most clinicians, patients recognize it as. So it's a little bit easier to say. It's, you know, one of the things that's most interesting to me, it's the most common reason that women aren't ovulating, aren't getting their periods. You know, about 12, even a little bit more, percent of women in their reproductive years have PCOS. And it's characterized by three sort of clinical features. One of them is are these irregular periods. The second is related to abnormal testosterone. So it can be male pattern hair growth or lab values of testosterone, and a classic sort of appearance of the ovaries on ultrasound.
Okay. Well, we should let our listeners join in. By the way, if you have a question, comment, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us as well at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Sam and Jackie here. Sam in Columbia, South Carolina, up first here. Hi, Sam. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi, Sam. Are you there?
Oh, yes. Thanks. I had a question, actually. I've been through some fertility treatments myself. I am 28 years old, but my main questions are about the AMH. I'm not sure what the hormone actually stands for, but I had that test done, which was probably what your guest was talking about as far as, like, routine tests are taken. And it was deemed that it was, like, 0.3, so it was low. But nobody said anything about it. So I'm just curious if that's typical for my age. Are there ways to improve it? And are there any, like, new technologies that are out there for women with low AMH?
All right. And AMH, Dr. Laura, what is that again?
Yeah, it's a really great question, Sam. So AMH stands for anti-mullerian hormone, and it goes back to the idea of ovarian reserve. And to give you a little bit of background, you know, guys get to make sperm every single day, right? Mm-hmm. But women are born with a certain number of eggs, and that number can decrease with time. So AMH refers to a hormone that's made by these small follicles that every woman has, and the higher it is, the more follicles you have. So I generally think of numbers of one as being normal, because that usually corresponds with having, you know, at least 10 follicles each month. You know, so it's really frustrating. I see a lot of people in Sam's situation where they're young and they have low anti-mullerian hormone levels. And there's two different ways that I think about it. One of them is it doesn't always correspond to someone's ability to get pregnant on their own. So if someone, you know, is trying to get pregnant, they just stopped their birth control pills and they're going to start trying, having a low AMH doesn't always decrease their chance of pregnancy initially. It can decrease your chance of success when you're doing fertility treatments, because when I'm doing treatments, I'm trying to get you to make multiple eggs, multiple follicles, and having a lower AMH can decrease the total number of follicles I can get. Now, Sam's in a not a bad position to be in because she still is young. And so there's a lot of, you know, good that age plays a, you know, a huge role in this. And so I have had people similar ages with even lower anti-mullerian hormones that were able to get pregnant, you know, with treatments like inseminations, like IVF. So it's absolutely not hopeless, Sam. You know, that's one of the most important things. It's frustrating. It's low for your age, but there are definitely a lot of sort of options that there are out there. You had asked about whether we can increase it with different medications. Unfortunately, we can't. There's definitely some variability when we check it. It can be falsely low if someone's on birth control pills. It can range, you know, different days of the month within different people. So sometimes, even if it's, you know, lower if we check it once, it can be a little bit higher if it's done at a different time of the month, but generally no medications to increase it.
Thanks very much for calling. Good questions. Let's go to Jackie in Appleton next. Jackie, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I recently just had a child for a friend of mine. I was a surrogate, and I guess I just wanted to remind people that surrogacy is an option. And from my personal experience, having gone through it, I feel as if the initial matching of the intended parents with the surrogate is the most important part of the process, making sure that you're matched in all aspects of life, as many as possible, politically, you know, religiously, spiritually, you know, everyday things, as much as you possibly can, because it prevents a lot of issues in the future. And I've heard some horror stories, but my personal experience has just been an amazingly positive one, because we were very careful in the beginning to make sure we matched up well.
Wow. Jackie, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Dr. Cooney?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the main points that Jackie brings up is that there are a lot of ways that we can help people get pregnant. And so you really want to focus on the parts that you need, right? You need an egg, you need a sperm, you need a uterus. It doesn't all have to come from the same person, the same couple. You know, we work a lot with people who are using donor egg, who are using donor sperm, or who need a surrogate, as she said, who can't carry the pregnancy themselves. And so this can be really helpful both for same-sex couples and, you know, other couples who need help getting pregnant.
Yeah. Thanks again for that call. Appreciate it. Mary in Lodi emailed to say she went through 4 long years of infertility. That was 20 years ago. After exhausting all treatment, she asked her doctor about acupuncture. Her doctor said it wouldn't work, so she gave it a try anyway. After a half a dozen sessions, her cycle, which was all over the place, up to 38 days for her whole life, straightened out. She now has a beautiful son and a beautiful daughter.
Yeah, congratulations. I get a lot of questions about acupuncture, all things like that. What's hard is, you know, we try and base everything we do on good quality studies. And as you can imagine, it's hard to do sham acupuncture. Mm-hmm. You know, do you put fake needles in? Do you put needles in the wrong spot? So there are definitely a lot of trials, studies out there that show a benefit of acupuncture. There's probably an equal number that don't show a benefit. When people ask me about it, I usually say if it's going to make you feel better, you know, anything that we do, whether it's acupuncture, massage, yoga, if it makes you feel happy, like less stressful, absolutely give it a try. It's not going to hurt.
Makes sense. Let's take another call. Mark in Washburn up next. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I had this. We had this problem, me and my wife. For a while, we weren't getting pregnant, and then we decided to check me first. And it was me. And so it seemed like instead of doing a bunch of tests, there was just basic one test I had to take and then a follow-up test. Not everybody wants to do this. You know, it's awkward and everything. But it ended up being me, so we could rule out her. And then we just decided to try to adopt. And we realized that was so expensive that we became foster parents first. And then lo and behold, after a couple years of that, we had got placed with a little girl, and after about 6 months of anguish of wondering if we're going to have to give her back to somebody, we ended up getting her 6 months after that, and now we have a daughter, and we're happy as can be.
Oh, good for you, Mark.
It's always adoption and foster care.
Another option. Yeah. Thank you so much. Dr. Cooney?
Yeah, no, I think Mark brings up another great point. And I try and keep this, you know, on the back of my mind when I'm talking to patients. You know, there's a million ways that people can be parents. And especially when someone's coming in after a failed cycle or they get, you know, bad news like Mark and, you know, his family got about, you know, the problem being him. There's a lot of ways that people can start a family and get what they want. So it's definitely important to keep all that in mind.
We are talking today with Dr. Laura Cooney in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the UW. Great to have her with us. I hope you'll join in with your questions, comments, or maybe experiences to share. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at infertility issues today with Dr. Laura Cooney. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Ann in Janesville next. Ann, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm a very happy grandmother. I have four grandchildren. My daughter had been married, and she and her husband decided to have a child or try to have a child. It didn't work. They tried. They didn't work. They went to a fertility clinic, and happily, her insurance paid for the cost of fertility. So that was an easier opportunity for them to have a child. They had a child, a wonderful little girl, and after trying again, she did not get pregnant. Now they did not have that kind of coverage, and so they paid for treatments themselves, which, of course, got to be quite costly. It cost her and him a lot of anxiety, and one day in discussing her concerns with a friend who had kind of a background in, I guess, things that are related to one's immune system, she asked if she had considered possibly that she might have celiac disease. So she was tested. She did have celiac, and within 6 weeks of going gluten-free, she was pregnant. Now, she was absolutely thrilled. She thought, based on that, maybe she should contact her fertility doctor and let her know what had happened. The fertility doctor said, oh, no, no, that could not possibly have anything to do with it.
Well, what do you think, Dr. Cooney?
Question. I've had patients ask about, you know, infertility and celiac disease before. I mean, and really infertility in any number of conditions, you know, there's a lot of medical conditions that people have and a lot of questions about what things are related. At the end of the day, I don't know if we have all of the answers. And this, you know, example illustrates it pretty well. I've looked into some of the data on it. And so that's all I know. You know, I don't know everything, but there have been studies that have looked at patients coming in who have a diagnosis of unexplained infertility, and they haven't found a higher percentage of people with celiac disease in that sort of unexplained infertility group. And you would have thought that if a lot of it could be attributed to something like celiac disease, it would have, there would have been this higher percentage. But I think this illustrates, you know, a good example of how you never know what little
Sure.
thing could be what is magic for that couple. And I do want to also bring up, you know, the caller mentioned the insurance and finances.
Yes.
It's a really frustrating thing. So there are some states in the country that mandate insurance coverage. Illinois is one of them, you know, our neighboring state. Mm-hmm. And that's great, you know, but it's really hard when couples come in and these are expensive treatments, and
yeah.
to be able to have people pay all this money and then not get pregnant, it's heartbreaking for them. It's heartbreaking for me, too. You know?
Yeah. Is there an average cost to something like this?
Yeah, it's a good question. It starts out very basic. So sometimes someone comes in and the main issue is that she's not getting regular periods. She's not ovulating. And the medication, oral medication that we give for that can be in the order of $10 to $50. So very
yeah.
inexpensive. If a couple just needs to do an insemination, The price of that, you know, depending on what other tests they have to do for that
sure.
cycle, can range from $400 to, you know, $700 or $800.
Yeah.
But once you start to get to in vitro fertilization, we're really talking, you know, $12,000 plus
yeah.
medication, which can be $5,000. And it ranges from clinic to clinic. So there's little variations in that, but you really are talking large amounts of money.
Thanks again for that call. Let's go to Ashley in Arborvitae. Ashley, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question regarding my current, I guess, small battle with infertility. I recently had a miscarriage about 2 months ago, and I had radioactive iodine treatment due to thyroid cancer and a total thyroidectomy when I was 19. I'm currently 32. And what I've been reading about the radioactive iodine treatment is that it actually does damage some eggs. In fact, when I did the treatment, I wasn't even allowed to be anyone within my childbearing years for about 6 weeks. So first of all, have you seen that play a factor in infertility in other people, like damaged eggs leading to the blighted ovum that I experienced, and if that's common?
Ashley, I'm sorry for your loss. Dr. Cooney, a comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ashley brings up a good point about cancer and cancer treatments in general. So we were talking earlier about the eggs that a woman is born with. Cancer treatments, whether it's chemotherapy or radiation, can damage these oocytes, even if, you know, someone has it when they're young, even when they're older. And it really varies based on the type of treatment, type of chemotherapy, type of radiation, location of radiation, whether it's in the pelvis or up higher, whether it gets to your whole body. There's ways that we can kind of check to see whether someone who has a history of cancer treatment, it has affected it. So hormones, AMH being one of them, FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone, being another, hormones that we can check to see if we think that someone has what we call this primary ovarian insufficiency, where that number of eggs that she has is sort of decreased because of cancer treatment. So it's definitely possible that different therapies can play a role. I don't know if I've had patients with Ashley's history in particular, but it wouldn't necessarily be surprising to me. So definitely something that I would do test-wise to see if there's any increased risk in situations like that. And whether it led to the blighted ovum in general, it's sort of hard to tell, but we definitely can see miscarriages in these patients.
I see. Ashley, thank you. Again, I'm sorry for your loss. We'll take another call. By the way, you could join in, too. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Have an open line or two. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Donna in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a daughter who has lost three babies. One was with a regular miscarriage at 9 weeks. The other two were in the late second trimester where there was fetal death, and then she had to go be induced. She has autoimmune disease, thyroid, and rheumatoid arthritis. And I was just wondering if there's something that can be done to help enhance those pregnancies so that she can carry them to the end.
Yeah, good. Another good question. Dr. Cooney?
Yeah, my goodness, Donna, I'm sorry for your family's losses.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I see a lot of patients with miscarriages. And the one thing I will say is that, again, miscarriages are also more common than people think. So it's really hard when it happens. And when you start talking to friends and family, you realize that a lot of people have gone through it as well. There's a basic workup that I do when someone comes in with this kind of history where they have multiple miscarriages. And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I hear someone who's had, you know, autoimmune diseases and things like that is testing. There's something called APLS, or antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, and it's sort of an acquired immune disease, meaning someone's not necessarily born with it but can develop it later in life. And the way I sort of think about it is your body can almost causes blood clots leading to the placenta, decreases the blood flow to the baby, and you can end up with, you know, either early miscarriages or really you can see these later fetal demises. If these antibodies, it's a blood test, if the antibodies are positive, the treatment is aspirin and Lovenox, which is a blood thinner to kind of help improve the blood flow to the placenta and can sort of decrease miscarriages. There's a bunch of other tests that can be done in people who have recurrent miscarriages. I will say the most frustrating thing is a lot of the times we don't actually find an explanation. And so recurrent miscarriages are one of the hardest things that I deal with, both emotionally and from sort of a scientific standpoint, because there's so much that we don't know.
But there's still, you know,
there's hope. Yeah, there's always hope. There's you know, again, multiple tests that we do, and I still tell people there's been some good studies that have looked at, you know, chance of having a live birth even after you've had multiple miscarriages, and a lot of it depends on age, but even someone with three prior miscarriages, again, if depending on their age, it could range easily from, you know, 70 to 80% of the time the next time they're pregnant they'll have a live birth. So there's always hope, even if we don't find an answer.
Donna, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. AJ in Columbus, your turn now. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. My question is there a cutoff age in terms of receiving any type of infertility treatments or procedures?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really ranges, I would say, from clinic to clinic. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, chances of success in general. So once a woman gets to be above a certain age, the chance of her having a successful, healthy pregnancy with her own eggs really decreases. So, you know, generally, we frequently use cutoffs around, you know, 44, 45 in average, depends again on different types of treatments. And that's because a lot of the studies have shown that in women over 45, even if we do things like in vitro fertilization, IVF, the chance of them having a successful live birth is really less than 1%. So to put someone through that complicated process, spend all the money when I'm giving them those such low percentages.
Yeah.
It's something that we don't recommend. But there are options, you know, not everyone's ready for this option, but there are options to use donor eggs. So even someone who's either older or a young woman who has had a lot of difficulty getting pregnant and we think it's related to the quality of her eggs can use a donor egg and successfully carry a healthy pregnancy.
And thinking about the age, I would expect for insurance companies, there's probably a cutoff with an insurance company as to whether or not they would.
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. One, I don't know the answer to. You know, I unfortunately don't get to deal with a lot of insurance companies because it's not covered in this state. If I was an insurance company, it would be, I would put an age cutoff on it, unfortunately, just when we're thinking about cost effectiveness, but it's tough.
Thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Lisa in Lake Mills up next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. I have two daughters in their early 20s who both have been receiving treatment for endometriosis, which includes Lupron, long-term birth control, and excision surgery with presacral neurectomy. One of them, in one of the surgeries, also, we found out later, had a ovary that atrophied, so she has one ovary. So I'm just wondering, you know, because they're wondering what all these drugs are going to do to them, and does this increase their risk of infertility, having one ovary, being on birth control for so long, and also being on the Lupron?
Yeah, a lot of good questions, Lisa. Let's take a step back and let me just tell everyone about endometriosis in case people don't know. So endometriosis, you know, we think about the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, and it's supposed to stay in the lining of the uterus. And every month it grows and it sheds, and that's why women get their periods. That lining can make its way into the pelvis. And one of the most common theories, we call it retrograde menstruation, which basically means that instead of people having a normal period, that blood makes it through the fallopian tubes into the pelvis. And with most women, it just, you know, your body absorbs it and it doesn't cause any problems. But with some women, you know, it sticks, and that's endometriosis, having these linings of endometrial cells that are throughout the pelvis. And each month when you get your period and you get these changes in hormones, that area can kind of grow and shed, and it can be incredibly painful, you know. So definitely, and I've seen people with the same history as your daughters, and I know it can really impact your life. So tease apart some of your questions, you know, you asked about effects of birth control pills. You know, there's lots of reasons that people are on long-term birth control pills, not just endometriosis. We do not think that there is any association between endometriosis and infertility. I'm very supportive of birth control pills. They actually decrease risks of ovarian cancer, so that's great. Lupron is a medication that is frequently used, as you mentioned, to treat endometriosis. It almost puts women in like a menopausal state, so they don't have these cyclings of hormones, so that these endometrial implants aren't growing and shedding and causing pain. Also do not think that there's any long-term fertility problems with Lupron. Endometriosis itself can be associated with infertility outside of all of these treatments. And there's multiple different ways. We don't understand all of it, but generally there's, you know, probably this inflammatory process that's going on in your pelvis that can impact the quality of the eggs, can impact the ability of, you know, a fertilized embryo to implant in the uterus. So definitely women with endometriosis can have difficulty getting pregnant, but not all of them. You know, there's tons of women out there with endometriosis who don't have infertility at all. So it's not a guarantee that your daughters are going to have problems. The other thing to think of is someone who's had endometriosis and lots of pelvic surgery. There's always a risk of scar tissue in the pelvis, risk of those fallopian tubes being blocked. So when it's time for someone to get pregnant, if they're having difficulty, definitely something to think about, you know, evaluating those fallopian tubes. And the final thing I will say is that we have great success, you know, doing IVF in vitro fertilization in women with endometriosis. So obviously, you know, I usually tell people to just start trying on their own when it, when they're ready, because you don't know if they're going to be that part of people who have infertility, or maybe they won't have any problems. But once they do, we have a lot of both diagnostic options and treatment options for them.
And thanks very much for calling, Lisa. Appreciate your call. In terms of in vitro fertilization, it's pretty successful then? Or?
You know, it really is successful. And the success rates have completely changed over time. It's really this fantastic. People have probably heard of the first IVF late baby. She just recently turned, I think, 40. So, you know, these are treatments that we've had for a while, but not forever, you know, so definitely a lot of new things over time. When I quote patients' sort of numbers in terms of live birth success, it obviously depends on age, it depends on their reason for infertility, but someone under 35, even under 37, you know, about 50% live birth rate with that first cycle, and if they were to do, you know, multiple cycles, three of them, 80%. So these are pretty good numbers.
Yeah, they are. I'm thinking about this whole business of infertility. It has got to put a strain on relationships. How do you address the psychological
effects? Yes, fantastic. Yeah, it's a really good question. So it's incredibly stressful. And, you know, you're taking this sort of natural process, then people all of a sudden they're measuring their temperature every day, they're peeing on a stick, they're, you know, looking at an app on the phone and deciding when to have intercourse, and that can be really stressful. We actually at Generations have two health psychologists that are available to all of our patients, and I think what's nice is that they understand infertility, they understand the process of IVF. You know, not all psychologists know what an oocyte is, and, you know, so that's great. And they work with patients who have had miscarriages, who are using donor sperm, donor eggs, surrogates, all of that, which is really fantastic. I frequently will screen most of my patients when they're coming in for symptoms of anxiety and depression. And, you know, if they screen positive, refer them specifically to our psychologist. But there have been good studies saying that women with infertility do have higher rates of depression and anxiety.
I would imagine anxiety would be practically 100% of everybody who comes in the place.
Yes.
I would think anyway. Well, let's take another call. Salkovan from Green Bay.
Hi. So my question was about postpartum psychosis and postpartum depression. What sort of treatments are there for those, for women experiencing that?
We're going to be dealing with some of that coming up on the show, but maybe a comment from you, Dr. Cooney?
I think one of the things that I think about just in terms of, you know, depression in general is a lot of people come to me and they're nervous and they've stopped all of their medication. And that is definitely not something that I recommend. You know, at the end of the day, healthy mom, healthy baby. So I work really closely with patients, with their healthcare providers, and really recommend that people stay on the medications that are working for them as they're trying to get pregnant. There are different medications that are safer in pregnancy, so if we need to switch someone, we can. As to sort of specific treatment for postpartum depression, psychosis, I think if you wait like 5 minutes, you'll get an expert on that. So definitely hang on the line.
Yeah, stay listening. Appreciate your call very much. Well, there are some more callers online, and we're starting to run out of time. But Soren in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Soren, thank you for calling. We have Soren on? Oh, maybe we don't have Soren on yet. Let's take a... Oh, now we do. Let's go to Soren. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, see, my daughter had breast cancer, double mastectomy, everything removed and reconstructed, including lymph nodes, and then chemo. And she was told she had to wait a year before they got pregnant, and it's going to be about a year and a half by the time the chemo was finished. What are her chances of having a normal pregnancy then?
Another good question. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it depends on two things. One of them is her age. You know, so women under 35 who have cancer, receive chemotherapy, are much more likely to resume their periods after treatment and, you know, be able to get pregnant on their own compared to women over 40. So women over 40, more likely with chemotherapy to have some of that sort of longer term damage that we had talked about to the eggs and have decreased chances. So, depends on her age, depends on her, what type of chemotherapy she had. But I'm seeing a lot of women, you know, with breast cancer who, again, especially if they're under that 40-year-old age range, who are able to get pregnant on their own and have a completely healthy pregnancy. It does bring up, you know, a really interesting point about fertility preservation in these patients that I'll just sort of mention quickly. So, it used to be in the past that someone's diagnosed, you know, with breast cancer and they immediately get treatment, they get their mastectomy, they get their chemo, their radiation, and they never talk to a gynecologist about these exact concerns. And more we're sort of trying to get these patients in to see us so that I can counsel, you know, patients like this ahead of time. And some people, depending on, you know, what chemotherapy they're going to get, have the option to undergo fertility preservation, to freeze their eggs ahead of time. And a lot of people don't decide to do it, but sometimes it's just sort of helpful to know that it's an option and to have these kind of sort of tailored discussions based on age and chemotherapy ahead of time.
Makes a lot of sense. Soren, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dr. Cooney, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. You'll come by and be with
us. Thank you for having
me. Yeah, you'll come by and be with us again sometime.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that very much. Dr. Laura Cooney, our guest today. She's an assistant professor in the UW Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology, and Infertility. Specializes in female infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, which I now know what PCOS is. She also looks at fertility preservation and third-party reproduction, and from the sound of it, does a wonderful job. So it's great to have her here, and we will have her back down the road, and we'll do this all over again. We did have a question relating to depression. Many women experience clinical depression or anxiety during pregnancy, and we'll talk about that next with Dr. Zachary Stowe from the UW Health. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking about mental health during and after pregnancy. But before we get to that, I want to ask Dr. Laura Cooney to stay with us for a few more minutes just to cover a few things that we weren't able to talk about the last 45 minutes. So we'll do that right now. And one of the things that I was really interested in learning about were new techniques that are being researched right now. Are there some options that you're really excited about or some things going on that excite you?
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple of things. One of them actually relates to what we were just talking about, so fertility preservation options. You know, I talked about freezing your eggs, you know, if someone is older. But what about these girls, you know, the girls who haven't gone through puberty, who are undergoing chemotherapy, radiation for leukemia? So there's been new studies looking at sort of ovarian tissue, you know, freezing. So actually doing surgery, removing a little bit of the tissue of the ovary, freezing that, letting the girl undergo her treatment or chemotherapy, and then putting it back in her body. So later on, putting that ovarian tissue back in her body. Somehow they're able to connect it, you know, get blood flow going. And there have been pregnancies, you know, throughout the country, throughout the world, from this sort of ovarian tissue cryopreservation, transplantation. So still very experimental. Not all, most, I will say, most universities aren't doing it. There are a couple around the country that have special, you know, approval, but very interesting. The other thing that I think about along those lines is the idea of something we call in vitro maturation. So a lot of times we have to wait. You know, your body goes through this cycle of getting the follicles growing, the eggs maturing, and we have to wait until your body sort of makes a mature egg. They're working really hard in the lab to try and mature these eggs outside of the body so that we're able to do similar things, you know, get ovarian tissue, get a whole bunch of these immature eggs, mature them in the lab, and then fertilize them. So stay tuned. You know, hopefully there'll be more options in the future.
Oh, my goodness. Well, one other thing that you mentioned just to kind of in passing was same-sex couples, and you didn't get weren't able to get into that right away. So let's deal with that for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have a lot of same-sex couples that come to see us. So I think it's important to spend a little bit of time talking about it. So when we think about two females, a lot of the times we're looking at getting donor sperm. There's a lot of sperm banks out there, either an anonymous sperm banks or some people use a known donor. So a friend or family member who will donate. And it's a sort of nicely regulated process, all done to sort of keep everybody safe. So if you're using a sperm donor, there's been a lot of STD testing. The sperm is actually quarantined for 6 months, tested again. So we really are sort of guaranteeing the safety of this couple. And what's nice is a lot of times people can do natural cycle insemination. So you don't have to take medication. You're just relying on your body's own ovulation. And then we're doing an insemination right at that right time. And, you know, success rates are fantastic.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying for two males, you know, we talked a little bit about surrogacy earlier, but we're usually looking at surrogacy. So getting an egg donor, you know, using their sperm, fertilizing the egg and putting that embryo back into a surrogate. So there's multiple options sort of for everybody.
And those donor sperm banks, someone else was telling me you can get quite a bit of information about the donor.
Yeah, absolutely. So people, you know, and it's helpful. You know, people a lot of times like to pick someone. You can look at eye color, hair color, ethnicity, social history. But sort of maybe even more importantly, there's a more genetic testing that's being done. So there are a lot of sort of recessive conditions, things like cystic fibrosis that can have pretty significant health impacts for the future child. And so a lot of these sperm donors are being tested for these kind of things. And it's okay if they're positive as long as, you know, the recipient's negative. But having that kind of information ahead of time can be really helpful.
Dr. Laura Cooney, our guest, and she's our next guest is on the way. We'll be here pretty soon. If you have a question for her yet or an experience, I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll take your call. In terms of your own experience, you know, how many people? What is a day like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's pretty varied. We have patients a lot of times when they're coming in doing treatment, they're getting a lot of ultrasound. So we're monitoring the size of these follicles that are growing, whether it's with IVF or IUI. So a lot of times I'm reading ultrasounds in the morning, smattered with some pregnancy ultrasounds, which are hopefully good news. So that's pretty exciting to see that end result and share that with my patients. We do inseminations, you know, every single day. And I will mention that we're open 7 days a week because you never know when someone's going to ovulate or be ready to get pregnant. And then we do our egg retrievals in the morning. So that's the last stage of IVF where after we've grown all these follicles, have these mature eggs, a woman goes a minor procedure where we, you know, remove the fluid from the follicles, take the egg, and, you know, the lab, and I haven't talked about the embryology lab yet, but that's really the key part of all of this. You know, the lab takes these eggs, they fertilize it with the sperm, and grow these embryos for 5 days. And so it's really the lab that brings, you know, our success rates, you know, at Generations, which are, you know, I'll brag a little higher than the national average. It's the lab, you know, as good as I might be, I give them the credit. So that's sort of part of the time interspersed with this, seeing new patients, having patients come back for return visits to talk about next steps. So some, you know, we also do minor procedures, hysteroscopies, so looking inside someone's uterus, specific types of ultrasounds to check their fallopian tubes. So a good variety, pretty interesting.
And how many people are involved, professionals are involved in this whole?
Yes. So, you know, you mean at our clinic?
Yeah.
So there's three physicians, including myself. We have a nurse practitioner. Start from the beginning, right? So we have a number of people at the front desk welcoming all of our patients as they come in. We have multiple nurses. We have medical assistants. We have a lab staff for embryologists to deal both with the embryos and the sperm. We have a Dr. Williams, as I mentioned, from the urology side. We have a genetics counselor. We have two health psychologists. We also, you know, we talked about the financial aspect. We have a financial counselor. So every new patient that comes in gets to meet with her so that you know exactly up front how much you're going to be charged for everything. I'm probably missing someone, but it's a huge team of people.
And insurance is not...
No, you know, most, and it's a good thing for people to think about. So there are some insurances that cover the workup. So most patients that I see come in and will have a basic coverage where they can get that semen analysis covered, the anti-Müllerian hormone level we talked about, other blood tests, evaluation of the uterus, their fallopian tubes. So they'll get that stuff coverage. Most people, you know, again, in the state of Wisconsin don't have coverage. There's multiple states out there that do, Boston, New Jersey, Illinois. So if you're lucky enough to come from one of those states, it doesn't matter where you get treatment. You can go anywhere. But if you have insurance in one of those states, it's more likely to be covered.
Wow. This has been really, really interesting for me. And I think our guest is here now. So I will thank you so much, Dr. Cooney, for being with us. And we'll call in our next guest, Dr. Laura Cooney. Thank you again for being with us.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Dr. Laura Cooney is an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology, and Infertility. And her specialty areas, female infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, fertility preservation, and third-party reproduction. It was great to have her along. And one of the things that came up in the discussion, we had callers asking, at least one caller, asking about mental health issues during and after pregnancy, and had some experiences with that, with friends and so forth. And it can be a really devastating kind of situation for a lot of people.